Her task of 14 yards, milk the cows, and have leisure time besides each day. It worked so well, I was continued in the employment of making looms, which were taken down to the plantation on the bayou. At this time, when John M. Tibbetts, a carpenter, came to the opening to do some work on Master's house, I was directed to quit the looms and assist him. For 2 weeks, I was in his company, planing and matching boards for ceiling, a plastered room being a rare thing in the parish of Avoyelles. John M. Tibbetts was the opposite of Ford in all respects. He was a small, crabbed, quick-tempered, spiteful man. He had no fixed residence that I ever heard of, but passed from one plantation to another, wherever he could find employment. He was without standing in the community, not esteemed by white men, nor even respected by slaves. He was ignorant, withal, and of a revengeful disposition. He left the parish long before I did, and I know not whether he is at present alive or dead. Certain it is, it was a most unlucky day for me that brought us together. During my residence with Master Ford, I had seen only the bright side of slavery. His was no heavy hand crushing us to the earth. He pointed upwards and with benign and cheering words addressed us as his fellow mortals, accountable, like himself, to the maker of us all. I think of him with affection, and had my family been with me, could have borne his gentle servitude without murmuring all my days. But clouds were gathering in the horizon, forerunners of a pitiless storm that was soon to break over me. I was doomed to endure such bitter trials as the poor slave only knows, and to lead no more the comparatively happy life which I had led in the great pine woods. Chapter 8. William Ford unfortunately became embarrassed in his pecuniary affairs. A heavy judgment was rendered against him in consequence of his having become security for his brother Franklin Ford. Residing on Red River above Alexandria, and who had failed to meet his liabilities, he was also indebted to John M. Tibbetts to a considerable amount in consideration of his services in billing the mills on Indian Creek, and also a weaving house, corn mill, and other erections on a plantation at Bayou Bœuf, not yet completed. It was therefore necessary, in order to meet these demands, to dispose of 18 slaves, myself among the number. 17 of them, including Sam and Harry, were purchased by Peter Compton, a planter also residing on Red River. I was sold to Tibbetts in consequence, undoubtedly, of my slight skill as a carpenter. This was in the winter of 1842. The deed of myself from freeman to Ford, as I ascertained from the public records in New Orleans on my return, was dated June 23, 1841. At the time of my sale to Tibbetts, the price agreed to be given for me being more than the debt. Ford took a chattel mortgage of $400. I am indebted for my life, as will hereafter be seen, to that mortgage. I bade farewell to my good friends at the opening and departed with my new master, Tibbetts. We went down to the plantation on Bayou Bœuf, distant 27 miles, from the pine woods, to complete the unfinished contract. Bayou Bœuf is a sluggish, winding stream, one of those stagnant bodies of water common in that region, sitting back from Red River. It stretches from a point not far from Alexandria in a southeasterly direction, and following its tortuous course is more than 50 miles in length. Large cotton and sugar plantations line each shore, extending back to the borders of interminable swamps. It is alive with alligators, rendering it unsafe for swine or unthinking slave children to stroll along its banks. Upon a bend in this bayou, a short distance from Cheneyville, was situated the plantation of Madame Ford, her brother Peter Tanner, a great landholder, living on the opposite side. On my arrival at Bayou Bœuf, I had the pleasure of meeting Eliza, whom I had not seen for several months. She had not pleased Mrs. Ford, being more occupied in brooding over her sorrows than in attending to her business, and had in consequence been set down to work in the field on the plantation. She had grown feeble and emaciated and was still mourning for her children. She asked me if I had forgotten them, and a great many times inquired if I still remember how handsome little Emily was, how much Randall loved her, and wondered if they were living still, and where the darlings could then be. She had sunk beneath the weight of an excessive grief. Her drooping form and hollow cheeks, too, plainly indicated that she had well nigh reached the end of her weary road. Ford's overseer on this plantation, and who had the exclusive charge of it, was a Mr. Chapin, a kindly disposed man and a native of Pennsylvania. In common with others, he held Tibbetts in light estimation, which fact, in connection with the $400 mortgage, was fortunate for me. I was now compelled to labor very hard. From earliest dawn until late at night, I was not allowed to be a moment idle, notwithstanding which, Tibbetts was never satisfied. He was continually cursing and complaining. He never spoke to me a kind word. I was his faithful slave and earned him large wages every day, and yet I went to my cabin nightly, loaded with abuse and stinging epithets. We had completed the corn mill, the kitchen, and so forth, and were at work upon the weaving house, when I was guilty of an act in that state punishable with death. It was my first fight with Tibbetts. The weaving house we were erecting stood in the orchard a few rods from the residence of Chapin, or the Great House, as it was called. One night, having worked until it was too dark to see, I was ordered by Tibbetts to rise very early in the morning, procure a keg of nails from Chapin, and commence putting on the clapboards. I retired to the cabin, extremely tired, and having cooked a supper of bacon and corn cake, and conversed a while with Eliza, who occupied the same cabin, as also did Lawson and his wife Mary, and a slave named Bristol, laid down upon the ground floor, little dreaming of the sufferings that awaited me on the morrow. Before daylight, I was on the piazza of the Great House, awaiting the appearance of Overseer Chapin. To have aroused him from his slumbers and stated my errand would have been an unpardonable boldness. At length he came out. Taking off my hat, I informed him Master Tibbetts had directed me to call upon him for a keg of nails. Going into the storeroom, he rolled it out, at the same time saying if Tibbetts preferred a different size, he would endeavor to furnish them, but that I might use those until further directed. Then, mounting his horse, which stood saddled and bridled at the door, he rode away into the field, whither the slaves had preceded him, while I took the keg on my shoulder, and proceeding to the weaving house, broke in the head and commenced nailing on the clapboard. As the day began to open, Tibbetts came out of the house to where I was, hard at work. He seemed to be that morning even more morose and disagreeable than usual. He was my master, entitled by law to my flesh and blood, and to exercise over me such tyrannical control as his mean nature prompted. But there was no law that could prevent my looking upon him with intense contempt. I despised both his disposition and his intellect. I had just come round to the keg for a further supply of nails as he reached the weaving house. "I thought I told you to commence putting on weather boards this morning," he remarked. "Yes, master, and I am about it," I replied. "Where?" he demanded. "On the other side," was my answer. He walked round to the other side, examining my work for a while, muttering to himself in a fault-finding tone. "Didn't I tell you last night to get a keg of nails of Chapin?" he broke forth again. "Yes, master, and so I did. And overseer said he would get another size for you if you wanted them, when he came back from the field." Tibbetts walked to the keg, looked a moment at the contents, then kicked it violently. Coming towards me in a great passion, he exclaimed, "God damn you! I thought you knowed something." I made answer, "I tried to do as you told me, master. I didn't mean anything wrong. Overseer said..." But he interrupted me with such a flood of curses that I was unable to finish the sentence. At length he ran toward the house, and going to the piazza, took down one of the overseer's whips. The whip had a short wooden stock braided over with leather, and was loaded at the butt. The lash was 3 feet long, or thereabouts, and made of rawhide strands. At first, I was somewhat frightened, and my impulse was to run. There was no one about except Rachel, the cook, and Chapin's wife. and neither of them were to be seen. The rest were in the field. I knew he intended to whip me, and it was the first time anyone had attempted it since my arrival at Avoyelles. I felt, moreover, that I had been faithful, that I was guilty of no wrong whatever, and deserved commendation rather than punishment. My fear changed to anger, and before he reached me I had made up my mind fully not to be whipped, let the result be life or death. Winding the lash around his hand and taking hold of the small end of the stock, he walked up to me and with a malignant look ordered me to strip. "Master Tibbets," said I, looking him boldly in the face, "I will not." I was about to say something further in justification, but with concentrated vengeance he sprang upon me, seizing me by the throat with one hand, raising the whip with the other, in the act of striking. Before the blow descended, however, I had caught him by the collar of the coat and drawn him closely to me. Reaching down, I seized him by the ankle, and pushing him back with the other hand, he fell over on the ground. Putting one arm around his leg and holding it to my breast so that his head and shoulders only touched the ground, I placed my foot upon his neck. He was completely in my power. My blood was up. It seemed to course through my veins like fire. In the frenzy of my madness, I snatched the whip from his hand. He struggled with all his power, swore that I should not live to see another day, and that he would tear out my heart. But his struggles and his threats were alike in vain. I cannot tell how many times I struck him. Blow after blow fell fast and heavy upon his wriggling form. At length he screamed, cried murder, and at last the blasphemous tyrant called on God for mercy. But he who had never shown mercy did not receive it. The stiff stock of the whip whooped round his cringing body until my right arm ached. Until this time I had been too busy to look about me. Desisting for a moment, I saw Mrs. Chapin looking from the window, and Rachel standing in the kitchen door. Their attitudes expressed the utmost excitement and alarm. His screams had been heard in the field. Chapin was coming as fast as he could ride. I struck him a blow or two more, then pushed him from me with such a well-directed kick that he went rolling over on the ground. Rising to his feet and brushing the dirt from his hair, he stood looking at me, pale with rage. We gazed at each other in silence. Not a word was uttered until Chapin galloped up to us. "What is the matter?" he cried out. "Master Tibbets wants to whip me for using the nails you gave me," I replied. "What is the matter with the nails?" he inquired, turning to Tibbets. Tibbets answered to the effect that they were too large, paying little heed, however, to Chapin's question, but still keeping his snakish eyes fastened maliciously on me. "I am overseer here," Chapin began. "I told Platt to take them and use them, and if they were not the proper size, I would get others on returning from the field. It is not his fault. Besides, I shall furnish such nails as I please. I hope you will understand that, Mr. Tibbets." Tibbets made no reply, but grinding his teeth and shaking his fist, swore he would have satisfaction, and that it was not half over yet. Thereupon he walked away, followed by the overseer, and entered the house, the latter talking to him all the while in a suppressed tone and with earnest gestures. I remained where I was, doubting whether it was better to fly or abide the result, whatever it might be. Presently, Tibbets came out of the house, and saddling his horse, the only property he possessed besides myself, departed on the road to Cheneyville. When he was gone, Chapin came out, visibly excited, telling me not to stir, not to attempt to leave the plantation on any account whatever. He then went to the kitchen, and calling Rachel out, conversed with her some time. Coming back, he again charged me with great earnestness not to run, saying my master was a rascal that he had left on no good errand, and that there might be trouble before night. But at all events, he insisted upon it, I must not stir. As I stood there, feelings of unutterable agony overwhelmed me. I was conscious that I had subjected myself to unimaginable punishment. The reaction that followed my extreme ebullition of anger produced the most painful sensations of regret. An unfriended, helpless slave. What could I do? What could I say? To justify in the remotest manner the heinous act I had committed, of resenting white man's contumely and abuse. I tried to pray. I tried to beseech my heavenly Father to sustain me in my sore extremity, but emotion choked my utterance, and I could only bow my head upon my hands and weep. For at least an hour I remained in this situation, finding relief only in tears, when, looking up, I beheld Tibbets, accompanied by two horsemen, coming down the bayou. They rode into the yard, jumped from their horses, and approached me with large whips, one of them also carrying a coil of rope. "Cross your hands," commanded Tibbets, with the addition of such a shuddering expression of blasphemy as is not decorous of to repeat. "You need not bind me, Master Tibbets. I'm ready to go with you anywhere," said I. One of his companions then stepped forward, swearing, if I made the least resistance, he would break my head. He would tear me limb from limb. He would cut my black throat, and giving wide scope to other similar expressions, perceiving any importunity altogether vain, I crossed my hands, submitting humbly to whatever disposition they might please to make of me. Thereupon Tibbets tied my wrists, drawing the rope around them with his utmost strength. Then he bound my ankles in the same manner. In the meantime, the other two had slipped a cord within my elbows, running it across my back and tying it firmly. It was utterly impossible to move hand or foot. With the remaining piece of rope, Tibbets made an awkward noose and placed it about my neck. "Now then," inquired one of Tibbets' companions, "where shall we hang the nigger?" One proposed such a limb extending from the body of a peach tree near the spot where we were standing. His comrade objected to it, alleging it would break, and proposed another. Finally, they fixed upon the latter. During this conversation, and all the time they were binding me, I uttered not a word. Overseer Chapin, during the progress of the scene, was walking hastily back and forth on the piazza. Rachel was crying by the kitchen door, and Mrs. Chapin was still looking from the window. Hope died within my heart. Surely my time had come. I should never behold the light of another day, never behold the faces of my children, the sweet anticipation I had cherished with such fondness. I should that hour struggle through the fearful agonies of death. None would mourn me, none revenge me. Soon my form would be mouldering in that distant soil, or perhaps be cast to the slimy reptiles that filled the stagnant waters of the bayou. Tears flowed down my cheeks, but they only afforded the subject of insulting comment for my executioners. At length, as they were dragging me towards the tree, Chapin, who had momentarily disappeared from the piazza, came out of the house and walked toward us. He had a pistol in each hand, and as near as I can now recall to mind, spoke in a firm, determined manner, as follows. "Gentlemen, I have a few words to say. You had better listen to them. Whoever moves that slave another foot from where he stands is a dead man. In the first place, he does not deserve this treatment. It is a shame to murder him in this manner. I never knew a more faithful boy than Platt. You, Tibbets, are in the fault yourself. You are pretty much of a scoundrel, and I know it, and you richly deserve the flogging you have received. In the next place, I have been overseer of this plantation 7 years, and in the absence of William Ford, am master here. My duty is to protect his interests, and that duty I shall perform. You are not responsible. You are a worthless fellow. Ford holds a mortgage on Platt of $400. If you hang him, he loses his debt. Until that is canceled, you have no right to take his life. You have no right to take it anyway. There is a law for the slave as well as for the white man. You are no better than a murderer. As for you," addressing Cook and Ramsey, a couple of overseers from neighboring plantations, "as for you, begone. If you have any regard for your own safety, I say, begone." Cook and Ramsey, without a further word, mounted their horses and rode away. Tibbets, in a few minutes, evidently in fear and overawed by the decided tone of Chapin, sneaked off like a coward as he was, and mounting his horse, followed his companions. I remained standing where I was, still bound, with the rope around my neck. As soon as they were gone, Chippen called Rachel, ordering her to run to the field and tell Lawson to hurry to the house without delay, and bring the brown mule with him, an animal much prized for its unusual fleetness. Presently the boy appeared. "Lawson," said Chippen, "you must go to the pine woods. Tell your master Ford to come here at once, that he must not delay a single moment. Tell him they're trying to murder Platt. Now hurry, boy. Be at the pine woods by noon if you kill the mule." Chapin stepped into the house and rode a pass. When he returned, Lawson was at the door, mounted on his mule. Receiving the pass, he plied the whip right smartly to the beast, dashed out of the yard, and turning up the bayou on a hard gallop, in less time than it has taken me to describe the scene, was out of sight. Chapter 9. As the sun approached the meridian that day, it became insufferably warm. Its hot rays scorched the ground. The earth almost blistered the foot that stood upon it. I was without coat or hat, standing bareheaded, exposed to its burning blaze. Great drops of perspiration rolled down my face, drenching the scanty apparel wherewith I was clothed. Over the fence, a very little way off, the peach trees cast their cool, delicious shadows on the grass. I would gladly have given a long year of service to have been enabled to exchange the heated oven, as it were, wherein I stood, for a seat beneath their branches. But I was yet bound, the rope still dangling from my neck, and standing in the same tracks where Tibbetts and his comrades left me. I could not move an inch, so firmly had I been bound. To have been unable to lean against the weaving house would have been a luxury indeed. But it was far beyond my reach, though distant less than 20 feet. I wanted to lie down, but knew I could not rise again. The ground was so parched and boiling hot, I was aware it would but add to the discomfort of my situation. If I could have only moved my position, however slightly, it would have been relief unspeakable. But the hot rays of a southern sun beating all the long summer day on my bare head produced not half the suffering I experienced from my aching limbs. My wrists and ankles and the cords of my legs and arms began to swell, burying the rope that bound them into the swollen flesh. All day, Chapin walked back and forth upon the stoop, but not once approached me. He appeared to be in a state of great uneasiness, looking first towards me and then up the road, as if expecting some arrival every moment. He did not go to the field, as was his custom. It was evident from his manner that he supposed Tibbetts would return with more and better armed assistance, perhaps to renew the quarrel, and it was equally evident he had prepared his mind to defend my life at whatever hazard. Why he did not relieve me, why he suffered me to remain in agony the whole weary day, I never knew. It was not for want of sympathy, I'm certain. Perhaps he wished Ford to see the rope about my neck, and the brutal manner in which I have been bound. Perhaps his interference with another's property in which he had no legal interest might have been a trespass, which would have subjected him to the penalty of the law. Why Tibbetts was all day absent was another mystery I never could divine. He knew well enough that Chapin would not harm him unless he persisted in his design against me. Lawson told me afterward that as he passed the plantation of John David Cheney, he saw the three, and they turned and looked after him as he flew by. I think his supposition was that Lawson had been sent out by Overseer Chapin to arouse the neighboring planters and to call on them to come to his assistance. He therefore undoubtedly acted on that principle that discretion is the better part of valor, and kept away. But whatever motive may have governed the cowardly and malignant tyrant, it is of no importance. There I still stood in the noontide sun, groaning with pain. From long before daylight I had not eaten a morsel. I was growing faint with pain and thirst and hunger. Once only, in the very hottest portion of the day, Rachel, half fearful she was acting contrary to the overseer's wishes, ventured to me, and held a cup of water to my lips. The humble creature never knew, nor could she comprehend if she had heard them, the blessings I invoked upon her for that balmy draught. She could only say, "Oh, Platt, how I do pity you," and then hasten back to her labors in the kitchen. Never did the sun move so slowly through the heavens. Never did it shower down such fervent and fiery rays as it did that day. At least, so it appeared to me. What my meditations were, the innumerable thoughts that thronged through my distracted brain, I will not attempt to give expression to. Suffice it to say, during the whole long day, I came not to the conclusion, even once, that the southern slave, fed, clothed, whipped, and protected by his master, is happier than the free colored citizen of the North. To that conclusion I have never since arrived. There are many, however, even in the northern states, benevolent and well-disposed men, who will pronounce my opinion erroneous, and gravely proceed to substantiate the assertion with an argument. Alas, they have never drunk as I have from the bitter cup of slavery. Just at sunset my heart leaped with unbounded joy as Ford came riding into the yard, his horse covered with foam. Chapin met him at the door, and after conversing a short time, he walked directly to me. "Poor Platt, you are in a bad state," was the only expression that escaped his lips. "Thank God," I said. "Thank God, Master Ford, that you have come at last." Drawing a knife from his pocket, he indignantly cut the cord from my wrists, arms, and ankles, and slipped the noose from my neck. I attempted to walk, but staggered like a drunken man, and fell partially to the ground. Ford returned immediately to the house, leaving me alone again. As he reached the piazza, Tibbetts and his two friends rode up. A long dialogue followed. I could hear the sound of their voices, the mild tones of Ford mingling with the angry accents of Tibbetts, but was unable to distinguish what was said. Finally, the three departed again, apparently not well pleased. I endeavored to raise the hammer, thinking to show Ford how willing I was to work, by proceeding with my labors on the weaving house, but it fell from a nerveless hand. At dark, I crawled into the cabin and laid down. I was in great misery, all sore and swollen, the slightest movement producing excruciating suffering. Soon the hands came in from the field. Rachel, when she went after Lawson, had told them what had happened. Eliza and Mary broiled me a piece of bacon, but my appetite was gone. Then they scorched some cornmeal and made coffee. It was all that I could take. Eliza consoled me and was very kind. It was not long before the cabin was full of slaves. They gathered round me, asking many questions about the difficulty with Tibbetts in the morning, and the particulars of all the occurrences of the day. Then Rachel came in, and in her simple language, repeated it over again, dwelling emphatically on the kick that sent Tibbetts rolling over on the ground. Whereupon there was a general titter throughout the crowd. Then she described how Chapin walked out with his pistols and rescued me, and how Master Ford cut the ropes with his knife, just as if he was mad. By this time, Lawson had returned. He had to regale them with an account of his trip to the pine woods, how the brown mule bore him faster than a streak of lightning, how he astonished everybody as he flew along, how Master Ford started right away, how he said Platt was a good nigger and they shouldn't kill him, concluding with pretty strong intimations that there was not another human being in the wide world who could have created such universal sensation on the road or performed such a marvelous John Gilpin feat as he had done that day on the brown mule. The kind creatures loaded me with the expression of their sympathy, saying, "Tibbetts was a hard, cruel man, and hoping Massa Ford would get me back again." In this manner they passed the time discussing, chatting, talking over and over again the exciting affair, until suddenly Chapin presented himself at the cabin door and called me. "Platt," said he, "you will sleep on the floor in the great house tonight. Bring your blanket with you." I rose as quickly as I was able, took my blanket in my hand, and followed him. On the way, he informed me that he should not wonder if Tibbetts was back again before morning. that he intended to kill me, and that he did not mean he should do it without witnesses. Had he stabbed me to the heart in the presence of 100 slaves, not one of them, by the laws of Louisiana, could have given evidence against him. I laid down on the floor in the great house, the first and the last time such a sumptuous resting place was granted me during my 12 years of bondage, and tried to sleep. Near midnight, the dog began to bark. Chapin arose, looked for the window, but could discover nothing. At length the dog was quiet. As he returned to his room, he said, "I believe, Platt, that scoundrel is skulking about the premises somewhere. If the dog barks again, and I am sleeping, wake me." I promised to do so. After the lapse of an hour or more, the dog recommenced his clamor, running towards the gate, then back again, all the while barking furiously. Chapin was out of bed without waiting to be called. On this occasion he stepped forth upon the piazza and remained standing there a considerable length of time. Nothing, however, was to be seen, and the dog returned to his kennel. We were not disturbed again during the night. The excessive pain that I suffered, and the dread of some impending danger, prevented any rest whatever. Whether or not Tibbets did actually return to the plantation that night, seeking an opportunity to wreak his vengeance upon me, is a secret known only to himself, perhaps. I thought then, however, and have the strong impression still, that he was there. At all events, he had the disposition of an assassin, cowering before a brave man's words, but ready to strike his helpless or unsuspecting victim in the back, as I had reason afterwards to know. At daylight in the morning, I arose sore and weary, having rested little. Nevertheless, after partaking breakfast, which Mary and Eliza had prepared for me in the cabin, I proceeded to the weaving house and commenced the labors of another day. It was Chapin's practice, as it is the practice of overseers generally immediately on rising, to bestride his horse, always saddled and bridled and ready for him, the particular business of some slave, and ride into the field. This morning, on the contrary, he came to the weaving house, asking if I had seen anything of Tibbets yet. Replying in the negative, he remarked there was something not right about the fellow. There was bad blood in him, that I must keep a sharp watch of him, or he would do me wrong some day when I least expected it. While he was yet speaking, Tibbets rode in, hitched his horse, and entered the house. I had little fear of him while Ford and Chapin were at hand, but they could not be near me always. Oh, how heavily the weight of slavery pressed upon me then! I must toil day after day, endure abuse and taunts and scoffs, sleep on the hard ground, live on the coarsest fare, and not only this, but live the slave of a blood-seeking wretch, of whom I must stand henceforth in continued fear and dread. Why had I not died in my young years, before God had given me children to love and live for? What unhappiness and suffering and sorrow it would have prevented! I sighed for liberty, but the bondsman's chain was round me, and could not be shaken off. I could only gaze wistfully toward the north and think of the thousands of miles that stretched between me and the soil of freedom, over which a black free man may not pass. Tibbets, in the course of half an hour, walked over to the weaving house, looked at me sharply, then returned without saying anything. Most of the forenoon he sat on the piazza, reading a newspaper and conversing with Ford. After dinner, the latter left for the pine woods, and it was indeed with regret that I beheld him depart from the plantation. Once more during the day, Tibbets came to me, gave me some order, and returned. During the week, the weaving house was completed, Tibbets in the meantime making no allusion whatever to the difficulty, when I was informed he had hired me to Peter Tanner to work under another carpenter by the name of Myers. This announcement was received with gratification, as any place was desirable that would relieve me of his hateful presence. Peter Tanner, as the reader has already been informed, lived on the opposite shore and was the brother of Mistress Ford. He is one of the most extensive planters on Bayou Bœuf, and owns a large number of slaves. Over I went to Tanner's, joyfully enough. He had heard of my late difficulties. In fact, I ascertained the flagging of Tibbet was soon blazoned far and wide. This affair, together with my rafting experiment, had rendered me somewhat notorious. More than once I heard it said that Platt Ford, now Platt Tibbets, a slave's name changes with his change of master, was a devil of a nigger. But I was destined to make a still further noise, as will presently be seen throughout the little world of Bayou Bœuf. Peter Tanner endeavored to impress upon me the idea that he was quite severe, though I could perceive there was a vein of good humor in the old fellow after all. "You're the nigger," he said to me on my arrival. "You're the nigger that flogged your master, eh? You're the nigger that kicks and holds Carpenter Tibbets by the leg and wallops him, are you? I'd like to see you hold me by the leg, I should. You're a portent character. You're a great nigger. Very remarkable nigger, ain't you? I'd lash you. I'd take the tantrums out of you. Just take hold of my leg, if you please. None of your pranks here, my boy. Remember that. Now go to work, you kicking rascal," concluded Peter Tanner, unable to suppress a half-comical grin at his own wit and sarcasm. After listening to this salutation, I was taken charge of by Myers and labored under his direction for a month, to his and my own satisfaction. Like William Ford, his brother-in-law, Tanner was in the habit of reading the Bible to his slaves on the Sabbath, but in a somewhat different spirit. He was an impressive commentator on the New Testament. The first Sunday after my coming to the plantation, he called them together and began to read the 12th chapter of Luke. When he came to the 47th verse, he looked deliberately around him and continued, "And that servant which knew his Lord's will..." Here he paused, looking around more deliberately than before, and again proceeded, "which knew his Lord's will and prepared not himself..." Here's another pause. "Prepared not himself, neither did, according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes." "Did you hear that?" demanded Peter, emphatically. "Stripes," he repeated, slowly and distinctly, taking off his spectacles, preparatory to making a few remarks. "That nigger that don't take care, that don't obey his lord, that's his master, do you see? That air nigger shall be beaten with many stripes. Now many signifies a great many. 40, 100, 150 lashes, that's scripture." And so Peter continued to elucidate the subject for a great length of time, much to the edification of his sable audience. At the conclusion of the exercises, calling up three of his slaves, Warner, Will, and Major, he cried out to me, "Here, Platt, you held Tibbets by the legs. Now see if you can hold these rascals in the same way till I get back from meeting." Thereupon he ordered them to the stocks, a common thing on plantations in the Red River country. The stocks are formed of two planks, the low one made fast at the ends of two short posts, driven firmly into the ground. At regular distances, half circles are cut in the upper edge. The other plank is fastened to one of the posts by a hinge, so that it can be opened or shut down in the same manner as the blade of a pocket knife is shut or opened. In the lower edge of the upper plank, corresponding half-circles are also cut, so that when they close, a row of holes is formed large enough to admit a Negro's leg above the ankle, but not large enough to enable him to draw out his foot. The other end of the upper plank, opposite the hinge, is fastened to its post by lock and key. The slave is made to sit upon the ground. When the uppermost plank is elevated, his legs just above the ankles, placed in the sub-half-circles, and shutting it down again and locking it, he is held secure and fast. Very often the neck instead of the ankle is enclosed. In this manner, they are held during the operation of whipping. Warner, Will, and Major, according to Tanner's accounts of them, were melon-stealing, Sabbath-breaking niggers, and not approving of such wickedness, he felt it his duty to put them in the stocks. Handing me the key himself, Myers, Mistress Tanner, and the children entered the carriage and drove away to church at Cheneyville. When they were gone, the boys begged me to let them out. I felt sorry to see them sitting on the hot ground and remembered my own sufferings in the sun. Upon their promise to return to the stocks at any moment they required to do so, I consented to release them. Grateful for the lenity shown them, and in order in some measure to repay it, they could do no less, of course, than pilot me to the melon patch. Shortly before Tanner's return, they were in the stocks again. Finally, he drove up and, looking at the boys, said with a chuckle, "Aha! You haven't been strolling about much today, anyway. I'll teach you what's what. I'll tell you of eating watermelons on the Lord's Day, you Sabbath-breaking niggers." Peter Tanner prided himself upon his strict religious observances. He was a deacon in the church. But I have now reached a point in the progress of my narrative when it becomes necessary to turn away from these light descriptions to the more grave and weighty matter of the second battle with Master Tibbets and the flight through the great Bacaudry Swamp. Chapter 10. At the end of a month, my services being no longer required at Tanner's, I was sent over the bayou again to my master, whom I found engaged in building the cotton press. This was situated at some distance from the great house, in a rather retired place. I commenced working once more in company with Tibbets, being entirely alone with him most part of the time. I remember the words of Chapin, his precautions, his advice to beware, lest in some unsuspecting moment he might injure me. They were always in my mind, so that I lived in the most uneasy state of apprehension and fear. One eye was on my work, the other on my master. I determined to give him no cause of offense, to work still more diligently, if possible, than I had done, to bear whatever abuse he might heap upon me, save bodily injury, humbly and patiently, hoping thereby to soften in some degree his manner towards me, until the blessed time might come when I should be delivered from his clutches. The third morning after my return, Chapin left the plantation for Cheneyville, to be absent until night. Tibbets, on that morning, was attacked with one of those periodical fits of spleen and ill-humor to which he was frequently subject, rendering him still more disagreeable and venomous than usual. It was about 9 o'clock in the forenoon when I was busily employed with the jet plane on one of the sweeps. Tibbets was standing by the workbench, fitting a handle into the chisel with which he had been engaged previously in cutting the thread of the screw. "You are not planing that down enough," said he. "It is just even with the line," I replied. "You're a damned liar," he exclaimed passionately. "Oh, well, master," I said mildly, "I will plane it down more, if you say so," at the same time proceeding to do as I supposed he desired. Before one shaving had been removed, however, he cried out, saying I had now planed it too deep. It was too small. I had spoiled the sweep entirely. Then followed curses and imprecations. I had endeavored to do exactly as he directed, but nothing would satisfy the unreasonable man. In silence and in dread, I stood by the sweep, holding the jet plane in my hand, not knowing what to do, and not daring to be idle. His anger grew more and more violent, until finally, with an oath, such a bitter, frightful oath as only Tibbets could utter, he seized a hatchet from the workbench and darted towards me, swearing he would cut my head open. It was a moment of life or death. The sharp, bright blade of the hatchet glittered in the sun. In another instant it would be buried in my brain, and yet in that instant, so quick will a man's thoughts come to him in such a fearful strait, I reasoned with myself. If I stood still, my doom was certain. If I fled, 10 chances to 1, the hatchet flying from his hand with a too deadly unerring aim would strike me in the back. There was but one course to take. Springing towards him with all my power, and meeting him full halfway, before he could bring down the blow, with one hand I caught his uplifted arm, with the other seized him by the throat. We stood looking each other in the eyes. In his I could see murder. I felt as if I had a serpent by the neck, watching the slightest relaxation of my grip, it coiled itself round my body, crushing and stinging it to death. I thought to scream aloud, trusting that some ear might catch the sound. But Chapin was away. The hands were in the field. There was no living soul in sight or hearing. The good genius which thus far through life has saved me from the hands of violence at that moment suggested a lucky thought. With a vigorous and sudden kick that brought him on one knee with a groan, I released my hold upon his throat, snatched the hatchet, and cast it beyond reach. Frantic with rage, maddened beyond control, he seized a white oak stick 5 feet long, perhaps, and as large in circumference as his hand could grasp, which was lying on the ground. Again he rushed toward me, and again I met him, seized him about the waist, and being the stronger of the two, bore him to the earth. While in that position I obtained possession of the stick, and rising, cast it from me also. He likewise arose and ran for the broad axe on the workbench. Fortunately, there was a heavy plank lying upon its broad blade in such a manner that he could not extricate it before I had sprung upon his back. Pressing him down closely and heavily on the plank, so that the axe was held more firmly to its place, I endeavored, but in vain, to break his grasp upon the handle. In that position, we remained some minutes. There have been hours in my unhappy life, many of them, when the contemplation of death as the end of earthly sorrow, of the grave as a resting place for the tired and worn-out body, has been pleasant to dwell upon. But such contemplations vanish in the hour of peril. No man in his full strength can stand undismayed in the presence of the King of Terrors. Life is dear to every living thing. The worm that crawls upon the ground will struggle for it. At that moment it was dear to me, enslaved and treated as I was. Not able to unloose his hand, once more I seized him by the throat. This time with a vice-like grip that soon relaxed his hold. He became pliant and unstrung. His face that had been white with passion was now black from suffocation. Those small serpent eyes that spat such venom were now full of horror. 2 great white orbs starting from their sockets. There was a lurking devil in my heart that prompted me to kill the human bloodhound on the spot. To retain the grip on his accursed throat till the breath of life was gone. I dared not murder him, and I dared not let him live. If I killed him, my life must pay the forfeit. If he lived, my life only would satisfy his vengeance. A voice within whispered me to fly, to be a wanderer among the swamps, a fugitive and a vagabond on the face of the earth was preferable to the life that I was leading. My resolution was soon formed, and swinging him from the workbench to the ground, I leaped a fence nearby and hurried across the plantation, passing the slaves at work in the cotton field. At the end of a quarter of a mile I reached the wood pasture, and it was a short time indeed that I had been running it. Climbing onto a high fence, I could see the cotton press, the great house, and the space between. It was a conspicuous position from whence the whole plantation was in view. I saw Tibbets cross the field toward the house and enter it. Then he came out, carrying his saddle, and presently mounted his horse and galloped away. I was desolate, but thankful. Thankful that my life was spared. Desolate and discouraged with the prospect before me. What would become of me? Who would befriend me? Whither should I fly? O God, thou who gavest me life, and implanted in my bosom the love of life, who filled it with emotions such as other men, thy creatures have, do not forsake me. Have pity on the poor slave. Let me not perish. If thou dost not protect me, I am lost. Lost! Such supplications, silently and unuttered, ascended from my inmost heart to heaven. But there was no answering voice. No sweet, low tone coming down from on high, whispering to my soul, "It is I. Be not afraid." I was the forsaken of God, it seemed, the despised and hated of men. In about 3/4 of an hour, several of the slaves shouted and made signs for me to run. Presently, looking up the bayou, I saw Tibbets and 2 others on horseback, coming at a fast gait, followed by a troop of dogs. There were as many as 8 or 10. Distant as I was, I knew them. They belonged on the adjoining plantation. The dogs used on Bayou Bœuf for hunting slaves are a kind of bloodhound, but a far more savage breed than is found in the northern states. They will attack a Negro at their master's bidding and cling to him as the common bulldog will cling to a four-footed animal. Frequently, their loud bay is heard in the swamps, and then there is speculation as to what point the runaway will be overhauled. The same as a New York hunter stops to listen to the hounds coursing along the hillsides and suggests to his companion that the fox will be taken at such a place. I never knew a slave escaping with his life from Bayou Bœuf. One reason is they are not allowed to learn the art of swimming and are incapable of crossing the most inconsiderable stream. In their flight, they can go in no direction but a little way without coming to a bayou, when the inevitable alternative is presented, of being drowned or overtaken by the dogs. In youth, I had practiced the clear streams that flow through my native district, until I had become an expert swimmer and felt at home in the watery element. I stood upon the fence until the dogs had reached the cotton press. In an instant more, their long, savage yells announced they were on my track. Leaping down from my position, I ran toward the swamp. Fear gave me strength, and I exerted it to the utmost. Every few moments I could hear the yelpings of the dogs. They were gaining upon me. Every howl was nearer and nearer. Each moment I expected they would spring upon my back. I expected to feel the long teeth sinking into my flesh. There were so many of them, I knew they would tear me to pieces, that they would worry me at once to death. I gasped for breath, gasped forth a half-uttered choking prayer to the Almighty to save me, to give me strength to reach some wide, deep bayou where I could throw them off the track or sink into its waters. Presently, I reached a thick palmetto bottom. As I fled through them, they made a loud rustling noise, not loud enough, however, to drown the voices of the dogs. Continuing my course due south, as nearly as I can judge, I came at length to water, just over shoe. The hounds at that moment could not have been 5 rods behind me. I could hear them crashing and plunging through the palmettos, their loud, eager yells making the whole swamp clamorous with the sound. Hope revived a little as I reached the water. If it were only deeper, they might lose the scent and thus, disconcerted, afford me the opportunity of evading them. Luckily, it grew deeper the farther I proceeded. Now over my ankles, now halfway to my knees, now sinking a moment to my waist, and then emerging presently into more shallow places. The dogs had not gained upon me since I struck the water. Evidently, they were confused. Now their savage intonations grew more and more distant, assuring me that I was leaving them. Finally, I stopped to listen, but the long howl came booming on the air again, telling me I was not yet safe. From bog to bog where I had stepped, they could still keep upon the track, though impeded by the water. At length, to my great joy, I came to a wide bayou, and plunging in, had soon stemmed its sluggish current to the other side. There, certainly, the dogs would be confounded, the current carrying down the stream all traces of that slight, mysterious scent which enables the quick-smelling hound to follow in the track of the fugitive. After crossing this bayou, the water became so deep I could not run. I was now in what I afterwards learned was the great Bacaudry Swamp. It was filled with immense trees, the sycamore, the gum, the cottonwood, and cypress, and it extends, I am informed, to the shore of the Calcasieu River. For 30 or 40 miles it is without inhabitants, save wild beasts, the bear, the wildcat, the tiger, and great slimy reptiles that are crawling through it everywhere. Long before I reached the bayou, in fact, from the time I struck the water until I emerged from the swamp on my return, these reptiles surrounded me. I saw hundreds of moccasin snakes, every log and bog, every trunk of a fallen tree over which I was compelled to step or climb was alive with them. They crawled away at my approach, but sometimes, in my haste, I almost placed my hand or foot upon them. They are poisonous serpents, their bite more fatal than the rattlesnakes. Besides, I had lost one shoe, the sole having come entirely off, leaving the upper only dangling to my ankle. I saw also many alligators, great and small, lying in the water or on pieces of floodwood. The noise I made usually startled them when they moved off and plunged into the deepest places. Sometimes, however, I would come directly upon a monster before observing it. In such cases, I would start back, run a short way round, and in that manner shun them. Straightforward, they will run a short distance rapidly, but do not possess the power of turning. In a crooked race, there is no difficulty in evading them. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, heard the last of the hounds. Probably they did not cross the bayou. Wet and weary, but relieved from the sense of instant peril, I continued on, more cautious and afraid, however, of the snakes and alligators than I had been in the earlier portion of my flight. Now, before stepping into a muddy pool, I would strike the water with a stick. If the waters move, I would go around it. If not, would venture through. At length the sun went down, and gradually night's trailing mantle shrouded the great swamp in darkness. Still, I staggered on, fearing every instant I should feel the dreadful sting of the moccasin, or be crushed within the jaws of some disturbed alligator. The dread of them now almost equaled the fear of the pursuing hounds. The moon arose after a time, its mild light creeping through the overspreading branches, loaded with long, pendant moss. I kept traveling forwards until after midnight, hoping all the while that I would soon emerge into some less desolate and dangerous region. But the water grew deeper, and the walking more difficult than ever. I perceived it would be impossible to proceed much farther, and knew not, moreover, what hands I might fall into, should I succeed in reaching a human habitation. Not provided with a pass, any white man would be at liberty to arrest me and place me in prison until such time as my master should prove property, pay charges, and take me away. I was astray, and if so unfortunate as to meet a law-abiding citizen of Louisiana, he would deem it his duty to his neighbor, perhaps, to put me forthwith in the pound. Really, it was difficult to determine which I had most reason to fear. Dogs, alligators, or men. After midnight, however, I came to a halt. Imagination cannot picture the dreariness of the scene. The swamp was resonant with the quacking of innumerable ducks. Since the foundation of the earth, in all probability, a human footstep had never before so far penetrated the recesses of the swamp. It was not silent now. Silent to a degree that rendered it oppressive, as it was when the sun was shining in the heavens. My midnight intrusion had awakened the feathered tribes, which seemed to throng the morass in hundreds of thousands, and the garrulous throats poured forth such multitudinous sounds. There was such a fluttering of wings, such sullen plunges in the water all around me, that I was affrighted and appalled. All the fowls of the air and all the creeping things of the earth appeared to have assembled together in that particular place, for the purpose of filling it with clamor and confusion. Not by human dwellings, not in crowded cities alone, are the sights and sounds of life. The wildest places of the earth are full of them, even in the heart of that dismal swamp. God had provided a refuge and a dwelling place for millions of living things. The moon had now risen above the trees, when I resolved upon a new project. Thus far, I had endeavored to travel as nearly south as possible. Turning about, I proceeded in a northwest direction, my object being to strike the pine woods in the vicinity of Master Ford's. Once within the shadow of his protection, I thought I would be comparatively safe. My clothes were in tatters. My hands, face, and body, covered with scratches, received from the sharp knots of fallen trees, and in climbing over piles of brush and floodwood. My bare foot was full of thorns. I was besmeared with muck and mud and the green slime that had collected on the surface of the dead water in which I had been immersed to the neck many times during the day and night. Hour after hour, and tiresome indeed, had they become. I continued to plod along on my northwest course. The water began to grow less deep and ground more firm under my feet. At last I reached the Pacodri, the same wide bayou I had swam while outward bound. I swam it again, and shortly after thought I heard a cock crow. But the sound was faint, and it might have been a mockery of the ear. The water receded from my advancing footsteps. Now I had left the bogs behind me. Now I was on dry land that gradually ascended to the plain, and I knew I was somewhere in the great pine woods. Just at daybreak, I came to an opening, a sort of small plantation, but one I had never seen before. In the edge of the woods, I came upon two men, a slave and his young master, engaged in catching wild hogs. The white man, I knew, would demand my pass, and not able to give him one would take me into possession. I was too wearied to run again, and too desperate to be taken, and therefore adopted a ruse that proved entirely successful. Assuming a fierce expression, I walked directly towards him, looking him steadily in the face. As I approached, he moved backwards with an air of alarm. It was plain he was much affrighted, that he looked upon me as some infernal goblin just arisen from the bowels of the swamp. "Where does William Ford live?" I demanded in no gentle tone. "He lives 7 miles from here," was the reply. "Which is the way to his place?" I again demanded, trying to look more fiercely than ever. "Do you see those pine trees yonder?" he asked, pointing to two, a mile distant, that rose far above their fellows, like a couple of tall sentinels overlooking the broad expanse of forest. "I see them," was the answer. "At the feet of those pine trees," he continued, "runs the Texas Road. Turn to the left, and it will lead you to William Ford's." Without further parley, I hastened forward, happy as he was, no doubt, to place the widest possible distance between us. Striking the Texas Road, I turned to the left hand, as directed, and soon passed a great fire, where a pile of logs were burning. I went to it, thinking I would dry my clothes, but the gray light of the morning was fast breaking away. Some passing white men might observe me. Besides, the heat overpowered me with the desire of sleep. So, lingering no longer, I continued my travels and finally, about 8 o'clock, reached the house of Master Ford. The slaves were all absent from the quarters, at their work. Stepping onto the piazza, I knocked at the door, which was soon opened by Mistress Ford. My appearance was so changed. I was in such a woebegone and forlorn condition, she did not know me. Inquiring if Master Ford was at home, that good man made his appearance, before the question could be answered. I told him of my flight and all the particulars connected with it. He listened attentively, and when I had concluded, spoke to me kindly and sympathetically, and taking me to the kitchen, called John and ordered him to prepare me food. I had tasted nothing since daylight the previous morning. When John had set the meal before me, the madam came out with a bowl of milk and many little delicious dainties, such as rarely pleased the palate of a slave. I was hungry, and I was weary. But neither food nor rest afforded half the pleasure as did the blessed voices speaking kindness and consolation. It was the oil and wine which the Good Samaritan in the great pine woods was ready to pour into the wounded spirit of the slave, who came to him stripped of his raiment and half dead. They left me in the cabin that I might rest. Blessed be sleep. It visiteth all alike, descending as the dews of heaven on the bond and free. Soon it nestled to my bosom, driving away the troubles that oppressed it, and bearing me to that shadowy region where I saw again the faces, and listened to the voices of my children who, alas for aught I knew in my waking hours, had fallen into the arms of that other sleep from which they never would arouse. Chapter 11. After a long sleep, sometime in the afternoon, I awoke refreshed, but very sore and stiff. Sally came in and talked with me while John cooked me some dinner. Sally was in great trouble, as well as myself, one of her children being ill, and she feared it could not survive. Dinner over, after walking about the quarters for a while, visiting Sally's cabin and looking at the sick child, I strolled into the madam's garden. though it was a season of the year when the voices of the birds are silent, and the trees are stripped of their summer glories in more frigid climes, yet the whole variety of roses were then blooming there, and the long, luxuriant vines creeping over the frames. The crimson and golden fruit hung half-hidden amidst the younger and older blossoms of the peach, the orange, the plum, and the pomegranate, for in that region of almost perpetual warmth, the leaves are falling and the buds bursting into bloom the whole year long. I indulged the most grateful feelings towards Master and Mistress Ford, and wishing in some manner to repay their kindness, commenced trimming the vines, and afterwards weeding out the grass from among the orange and pomegranate trees. The latter grows 8 to 10 feet high, and its fruit, though larger, is similar in appearance to the jelly flower. It has the luscious flavor of the strawberry. Oranges, peaches, plums, and most other fruits are indigenous to the rich, warm soil of the Voyles. But the apple, the most common of them all in colder latitudes, is rarely to be seen. Mistress Ford came out presently, saying it was praiseworthy in me, but I was not in a condition to labor, and might rest myself at the quarters until Master should go down to Bayou Bœuf, which would not be that day, and it might not be the next. I said to her, to be sure I felt bad, and was stiff, and that my foot pained me, the stubs and thorns having so torn it, but thought such exercise would not hurt me, that it was a great pleasure to work for so good a mistress. Thereupon she returned to the great house, and for 3 days I was diligent in the garden, cleaning the walks, weeding the flower beds, and pulling up the rank grass beneath the jasmine vines, which the gentle and generous hand of my protectress had taught to clamber along the walls. The fourth morning, having become recruited and refreshed, Master Ford ordered me to make ready to accompany him to the bayou. There was but one saddle horse at the opening, all the others with the mules having been sent down to the plantation. I said I could walk, and bidding Sally and John goodbye, left the opening, trotting along by the horse's side. That little paradise in the great pine woods was the oasis in the desert, toward which my heart turned lovingly during many years of bondage. I went forth from it now with regret and sorrow.